Petitions have been a common form of protest throughout history, but gone are the days of having to use handwritten letters to bring attention to a cause. Now, petitions are online. One company called Change.org has contributed to the phenomenon. NPR's Teresa Tomassoni reports how the company's website allows people to start change in their communities with a few clicks of a mouse.
When Jenny Holcomb's 15-year-old daughter Emily was charged with felony assault in Hamilton, Alabama, for slapping a teacher, she was shocked.
The sheriff's department was standing there, served me papers, and wanted to serve Emily papers until I told them that, you know, she was a child with autism that was nonverbal.
Afterwards, Holcomb says a friend wrote about the incident on Facebook.
And from Facebook, it spreaded. And that's when Lydia Brown contacted me and asked me, you know, if she could do a petition to have the charges and stuff dropped on Emily.
The woman who wrote the petition, Lydia Brown, is autistic herself. She's been an advocate for people with the disorder since high school. But the 18-year-old Georgetown University student had never written a petition before.
So I was kind of like, I don't know how I should do this. I don't know if there's a template anywhere.
Some friends suggested she use change.org, a website which lets people write petitions and collect electronic signatures online to protest or support causes that interest them.
And I wrote this petition that came across in this very legalese, very formal kind of, we affirm that, therefore we demand that kind of format.
Brown later realized most petitions on the site are not written so formally. Most are written as first-person letters that answer three basic questions.
What you want to change, who has the power to change that, and why others should join you.
Ben Rattray is the founder and CEO of Change.org. The 31-year-old came up with the idea as a senior in college.
When I was at Stanford, there's this combined interest both in entrepreneurship and in political social change.
So in 2007, he decided to make Change.org into a profitable business. Large organizations like the Sierra Club and Oxfam pay to have their petitions promoted on the site. And the revenues from those petitions allow everyone else to use the site for free. Alan Weber is an industry analyst. He sees Change.org as a leading example of what digital social action should look like. But, he says, it's important to realize its success is wrapped up in the rise of other social media.
I think it's part of an ecosystem. People are going to share petitions, but they're going to share those petitions via Facebook or via Twitter.
There have been at least 1,000 successful petitions, according to Change.org. The one that got the most attention was the petition against Bank of America's plan to charge debit card fees. Rattray acknowledges that many of the campaigns launched on his site are supported by other organizations and people outside of his company. For instance, Jenny Holcomb had already hired a lawyer to help her fight the charges against her daughter before Lydia Brown started the petition drive.
I think eventually we would have got, you know, what we wanted to, but I don't think it would have been as soon.
Within a few days of the petition launch, the felony assault charges were dropped against her daughter. Lydia Brown has since written two more petitions on Change.org related to autism. Teresa Tomassoni, NPR News.
With me now is Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, video pick of the week. Flora, what have you got for us today?
This one is a good one.
It's always
like
a good
everyone
one.
Everyone should get out their iPhones right now in the audience and look. This one was submitted, or I actually tracked down the person who made it. You may have seen this video. It's a Lego shuttle that makes it into space.
Ah,
anybody
yes.
I know Ira watched it. That was always a good sign. So I wanted to track down the story behind this because the headlines were all, a teen sends a Lego shuttle into space and then he videotaped it, and that's the video on our website. Because I thought there's got to be a good story here. So I Skyped Raul Ida.
That's his name.
In Romania.
Yeah.
And he's an 18-year-old who did this pretty much on his own. And this isn't his first project. Before this, he was building jet engines.
An 18-year-old.
Yeah, from the internet.
Don't or try this at home. Well, he tried it at home,
I guess. He sent me like these amazing pictures of jet engines, and it looks like a basement, you know, flaming out. It was just incredible. So our video this week is kind of the backstory, the making of his Lego shuttle video, which has gotten tons of hits in the last, hundreds of thousands.
It's a camera on, it's a Lego guy with a camera on a weather balloon, right?
Right, so they take this huge helium balloon, you know, big rubber weather balloon, fill it with helium, and then it goes up 115,000 feet. It takes two and a half hours to go up, and then, you know, it's shorter on the way down. But
yeah, and a little bumpier.
Right, but so they put in a GPS tracker, and then they go find it, and it was, you know, over 100 miles away. But they were lucky because it didn't land in the trees. That's apparently a big problem when you send Lego shuttles into space.
That's why we have GPS, but it's really technically in space going up so high.
Yeah.
And you can see the curvature of the Earth on
it. It's so beautiful. It really is.
And he did it on the cheap in his house. After building the rocket engine.
Yeah, so I asked him, you know, where did you get the funding? And this was a really interesting little tidbit, I thought. He met someone over Twitter, a sort of entrepreneur who works in marketing, and was kind of trying to sell his ideas about rocketry because he also wants to build a rocket. As he said, he wants to go to space so badly that he said he'll build the rocket himself if he has to. So he hooked up with this guy in Australia who said, okay, you know, this is a tiny budget for what could be really cool, and...
There you have it.
All right.
There it is, up on our website at sciencefriday.com, our video pick of the week. Flora, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for today. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor, our program senior producer, Annette Heist. Charles Berquist back there is our director. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Saran Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo, our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rausch, our technical director at the controls here. And we had audio engineers Sean Phillips and Peter Elena in Washington. Peter Granitz and Jerry Tennant at NPR. If you missed any part of our program, go over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast and our audio and video. And before we go in this first section, I want to wish a special congratulations to the Research Corporation for Science Advancement, celebrating their 100th anniversary this year. This nonprofit organization has helped a lot of scientists. They gave money to Albert Einstein, rocket pioneer Robert Goddard, and they helped make our stay in Washington possible. So I want to wish a happy 100th birthday, and to Jim Gentile, who was up here from RCSA. Thank you all for helping us make Science Friday possible here in Washington. I'm Ira Flato in Washington.
The public radio show This American Life has retracted a lengthy story it ran in January. The report painted an ugly picture of working conditions at Chinese factories where they manufacture iPhones and iPads. The story focused on a monologue told by performer and activist Mike Daisy about his interviews with factory workers. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik joins me now. And David, this was This American Life's most popular podcast. How are they explaining their decision to retract the story?
Well, I think it's worth starting by taking a moment from the broadcast itself, This American Life, produced by our colleagues over at WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio. Here's Mike Daisy. He's talking a little bit about what he found when he was in China. And let's play that clip for a moment.
The problem is that N-hexane is a potent neurotoxin, and all these people have been exposed. Their hands shake uncontrollably. Most of them can't even pick up a glass. I talk to people whose joints in their hands have disintegrated from working on the line, doing the same motion hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. It's like carpal tunnel on a scale we can scarcely imagine. And you need to know that this is eminently avoidable.
So that very segment prompted questions, among others, from marketplaces. Rob Schmitz, he's a correspondent for Marketplace American Public Media over in China. And he's done a lot of reporting on this and related issues. And it struck him that actually the people who had worked in plants for manufacturing items for Apple, who had been poisoned by that element that Daisy was talking so compellingly about, were actually about 1,000 miles away. And he started raising questions. One of them was solved by just doing a Google search. He looked for a translator that Daisy had sworn to producers over at This American Life could no longer be reached. You know, Rob did this Google search, found her within less than a minute online, and was able to call and start challenging a lot of the assertions he made. A lot of the claims started to unspool.
Well, Mike Daisy had previously presented his findings about Apple as fact. What does he say now?
That's right. I mean, he's not only been a performer on this, but an activist stirring calls for there to be a lot more careful observation of what Apple is up to in China. Now what he says is he stands by his work. He stands by his performance, the one-man show called The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, which has gotten critical raves. But he says, look, I use tools differently than those of journalism. I'm an artist. He says so he regrets that he allowed This American Life to air an excerpt from his monologue. But otherwise, he says he's using a combination, and this is a quote, of fact, memoir, and dramatic license to tell his story. And he said, I believe it does so with integrity.
Well, he's standing by his work, but This American Life is not. What have they said about what they're going to do?
Well, they're going to devote an hour-long segment this weekend. Listeners are going to be able to hear on hundreds of stations across the country to unpack what went wrong. And they actually did what Schmitz described to me as a collaboration with Marketplace, of a detective work or an autopsy on their own work to figure out what they did wrong. An impressive element of the segment when I heard it back in January was that they had done a fair amount of fact-checking. In fact, the broad strokes of what Mike Daisy claimed occurred in China appears to have occurred there. But a lot of the details are wrong, and it undermines a lot of his assertions. They want to keep faith with their listeners. And I think that what a lot of journalists do is not simply condemn a news organization when something like this happens, but looks to see how that outlet deals with the allegations. In this case, it appears as though This American Life is working very hard to keep faith with its listeners once questions were raised.
Okay. NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks very much.
You bet.
Jiro Ono has given more than 75 years of his life to one job. The sushi chef started learning his trade at the age of 9. His father had abandoned the family, forcing Jiro's impoverished mother to send him out to a Dickensian world of kitchen work. Today, his sushi restaurant, Tsukiyabashi Jiro, is considered the best in the world. So good, it's earned the top Michelin rating of 3 stars, even though it's located deep underground next to a Tokyo subway platform. Jiro presides from behind the counter, a formidable, focused presence, his hands molding the soft rice beneath delicate slices of fish. A new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, follows the 86-year-old's almost obsessive search for the perfect sushi. The film's director, David Gelb, joined us here at NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you, Renee.
How did you get Jiro to let you follow him?
Well, I owe a great deal to the food writer Masahiro Yamamoto. I like to refer to him as a sushi poet. He was the judge of Iron Chef in Japan. He convinced Jiro that I would do a fair telling of his story.
One thing about the film that brings you in is when one first meets Jiro, you know he's amazing at what he does. You know he's the best sushi chef in the world. And yet he seems quite fierce. And bit by bit, you see this other side. He'll break out into a little smile. And that maybe in a way that seems more of a gift.
Absolutely. When I first ate at the restaurant, I was very, very nervous. Because I'd heard, you know, what a serious man he is and kind of how stoic he is. And he doesn't talk to the customers. And the meal lasts 30 minutes and costs $350. And, you know, you're out of there as soon as you finish, basically. But as soon as he finished service and the customers left the restaurant and he becomes, you know, very personable, kind gentleman. And what I realized is that it's not that he's mean. He's just concentrating, using his full attention on the task at hand, which is making sushi. He's just focused on making every single piece of sushi the best sushi of his life.
You know, does it matter that it's such a small place? His entire restaurant consists of a bar with 10 stools?
Yeah, there are 10 seats in the bar. They do maybe one turnover for lunch and one turnover for dinner. That's all the people that he can serve to his standard, because that's all the fish that exists in the fish market that will satisfy him.
There are plenty of examples in this film of the lengths that Jiro goes to make the ultimate sushi. One of them, which he doesn't do himself, massaging the octopus. What's that?
Octopi are often tragically under-massaged in sushi restaurants.
So they, you end up chewing on them.
Yeah, well, octopus, you know, I think a lot of people that eat octopus in a normal sushi restaurant, especially Americans, you know, octopus isn't that popular because it's known as being chewy and it has kind of suction cups. And, you know, a lot of people think it's a piece of rubber. And Jiro laments that as well because he thinks that octopus often has no flavor. And so he developed a way to make octopus delicious. It needs to be massaged for an hour every day in order to both tenderize it and also to bring out the flavors of what the octopus has been eating. The octopus that they get has a fantastic diet of clams and shellfish, and so by massaging the octopus, they're unlocking all the flavor that's inside of it, and that's one of the reasons that Jiro's octopus is so delicious.
Your film takes us to this fish market. Let's take a listen to the sound of it. Describe for us what we're hearing.
This is the tuna auction, and the procedure has been unchanged for over 100 years. There's no digital record keeping of any kind. It's all, you know, completely analog. The auctioneers are ringing bells to indicate where the auctions are taking place on the floor, because there may be a few auctions happening at the same time for different fish. And the auctioneers are sort of like yelling, like in a Sotheby's, essentially. And it kind of takes on a very musical quality.
Almost like jazz. Whereas the rest of the film, there's a score that is classical music. And it seems as if you structure the story as a kind of symphony.
Certainly. And this is something that Yamamoto, our food writer and narrator, he conveyed this to me when I first started talking to him about Jiro and about sushi, is that Jiro's sushi, his sushi course is like a concerto. It's like a piece of music. And it has movements, and it has, you know, kind of hills and valleys, all very delicious, but the hills and valleys meaning the contrast and the flavors between the different sushi.
Throughout the film, we see sushi. Sushi that's extremely elegant and exquisite to look at. Even without being able to taste it, it does give one the impression that it's quite sublime.
So they're actually quite easy to shoot because you just have to point the camera from a compelling perspective, and the sushi does the work itself. First of all, just Jiro's sushi, they look like jewels. You know, they are incredibly beautiful. When he places a piece of sushi on the plate, it settles into place. And Yamamoto, the food writer, describes it as the soft landing. And it's because Jiro packs the rice firmly so it retains its shape, but also very lightly so that there's air that moves within the rice.
How does it taste?
The rice is warm and fluffy, each grain retains its perfect shape, and it's just slightly al dente at the same time. And when you put a piece of sushi in your mouth, the rice kind of poofs. Eric Repair, the French chef, described it where the rice just poofs in your mouth, and it just the flavors combine with the fish. And what's happening, the rice is elevating the fish. And when you've mastered that balance like Jiro has, the only way to describe the sensation of eating it is umami. And that's kind of the perfect balance where you just taste the true essence of the fish.
And umami was communicated by his oldest son as the experience of ah.
Of ah, exactly. Umami is just the feeling of satisfaction while eating. You just are just moved by what you eat. After having eaten there and understanding all the work that goes into it, eating a piece of sushi from Jiro is really quite emotional. Especially when you know the vast labors that have gone into creating that single bite.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
David Gelb is the director and producer of the new documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And from NPR News, this is Morning Edition, produced by Nishant Dahiya. Our senior producers are Cindy Carpy and Barry Gordimer and Jim Wildman. Senior supervising producers are Cara Tallo and Tracy Wall. Our executive producer is Madalie Kosicka. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music is written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. The NCAA tournament is in full swing. Another 16 games today, full of victory and celebration, despair and defeat. And for every losing team, there's a pack of opposing fans convinced that their jeers contributed to missed free throws and flat jumpers. NPR's fearless Mike Pesca has been spending time with the hecklers.
Last night, the UConn Huskies fell to the Iowa State Cyclones thanks to the play of Cyclone star Royce White and team rebounding. At least, that's the reason most basketball experts would offer. But there were perhaps other reasons, about 25 reasons. They painted their faces, wore hockey jerseys, and occasionally toted trombones. They were the Iowa State pep band, and they were riding UConn all night. There was the unvariated scream technique, the attempt at cross-sport confusion, and the 80s hair band Gambit. The Last Heckle had as much staying power as Twisted Sister themselves, but the point isn't necessarily to actually affect the shooter. It's to entertain your band of brothers and sisters, which the Cyclone pep band acknowledged.
Do you guys think your heckling rattled the other team at all?
Does it matter?
It worked. The Cyclones won last night, just like the Cincinnati Bearcats won today. Band member Brian Pack and his teammates recall one glorious heckle during a key late-season game. The opponent was Seton Hall, the victim, Herb Pope.
The whole place got quiet, and we all yelled, "Herb," right as he was about to release the ball, and he missed both free throws, and he glared right at us at the end. It was hilarious.
During home games, bands often spur on crowds, but here in the NCAA tournament, where some teams have small cheering sections and arenas are generally cavernous, the band often is heckle central. Even then, says Bearcat band member Jay Keller, the tournament's organizer puts a damper on the damage done.
Like, it's hard to do anything because, like, the NCAA staff keeps us from, like, standing up and doing what we normally do.
Which is to stand on seats, wave their instruments, release feral geese into the arena. Okay, no geese. But it does bring up the question, is this poor sportsmanship? Which brings up the answer, no. Of course, there are some boundaries that should not be crossed. But for the most part, yelling Herb isn't a big insult unless the guy is not named Herb. The players themselves usually evince a nonchalance, but Iowa State star Royce White allows heckling can work.
My first game down in Austin, Texas, and I airballed a free throw, and then they gave me a lot about it, and then I airballed another free throw, and you know, my mind just kind of got away from, you know, what I needed to be focused on.
And just to show that the taunter can become the taunted, consider the source of those jeers that shook up White. They came from the Texas Longhorns. And who did the Cincy band aim their Bearcat calls at this afternoon? The Texas Longhorns, who lost the game. It is the circle of grief. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Nashville, Tennessee.